They ran it as an experiment and it didn't move any metrics. And everyone got very sad. They kind of ended up like disbanding the effort, disbanding the team. And I looked at it and it was like, they ran it for like a few days or a week. It needed to run for like a month and a half. Like it was nowhere close to enough data. Like there was no way you were going to detect anything. Like this is sort of what I was getting at in terms of these failure modes, is that there can be a huge issue where you internalize that something didn't work, but it's really just that you didn't handle all these failure modes and now bad institutional knowledge had been created.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. Today, we have Che Sharma. Che was the fourth data scientist at Airbnb. He worked on fraud detection and A-B testing. After that, he joined Webflow as an early employee. In 2021, he became the founder and CEO of Apple, a next-gen A-B experimentation platform designed for modern data and product team to run more trustworthy and advanced experiments. Their customers include Miro, Twitch, and DraftKings. He studied electrical engineering in college and has a master's degree in statistics from Stanford University. Today, we'll talk about A-B testing best practices, A-B testing for machine learning models, and Che's career journey. If you enjoy the show, subscribe to the channel and give me a 5-star review. Welcome to the show, Che.
It's great to be here, Daliana. Excited to chat.
Yeah. Actually, in Amazon, I worked at A-B testing for over 3 years and analyzed hundreds of experiments. So this topic is really close to my heart and I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I always admired Amazon. Jeff Bezos was such a big fan of experimentation. We didn't have the same luxury at Airbnb, but it was very nice.
Yeah, I was going to ask because I know Airbnb is a design-focused company. So what was it like to be the fourth data scientist in Airbnb?
It was awesome. I mean, Airbnb is such a special company. I have so much admiration for that company and for Brian Chesky and everything they've built. Definitely an incredible culture. From a data perspective, it was kind of an interesting environment because on one hand, it's such a fruitful space. Two-sided marketplace is rich with data problems, international two-sided marketplace. But on the other hand, it's a design-led company. And that means the leadership is not kind of naturally leaning towards data for as a first-class citizen to decision-making. And so for an early data team, before we had a warehouse, before we had much tech, to solve both the technology, the problems before a snowflake world, and to also kind of surmount this cultural issue of people not reaching for data, it was a lot to overcome. And a lot of kind of what led me to build Eppo was seeing just how transformative experimentation was for that journey. Like, you know, that was for anyone who was there as early as I was before we started investing in tooling and everything. We all saw it was experimentation that brought data to the mainstream.
Yeah. And so what are some interesting results of the experiments or anything counterintuitive you learned through running experimentation there?
Yeah. The big thing you realize right away is just how unexpected the outcomes can be. You launch all these things and you think they're all great. You've done so much research. You've done all these focus groups, UX research sessions. You know, it looks so polished, looks beautiful, and it seems so logical. And yet you put it out there and the metrics don't move or they move the opposite direction that you think. And you really start to learn a lot about, you know, what exactly is your business and what are the drivers of it. You know, one example is when I first joined Airbnb in 2012, we launched this product called Neighborhood Guides. And so the idea was, suppose you're visiting San Francisco and you say you're going to stay in the Mission, you would be shown these like 5-page, 10-page glossy guides of like, here is Tartine Bakery. You should get a morning bun there. Here is the Lawyers Park, a good place that people love. Give you this kind of guide of what to do in the Mission. And it was this big thing. Brian Chesky thought a lot of it. He got up and did a bunch of PR. There's still press releases today from that era of like all the PR that was done around it because the company was so confident in that product. And then down the road, we did an A-B experiment to see how valuable this thing was. And lo and behold, there was a huge metric lift to remove it altogether, to get it completely out of the product. And it was very instructive because the thing we realized is that we aren't really TripAdvisor. We're not some like content system that monetizes via ads and time on site. We monetize by people making bookings, booking Airbnbs. And a big 10-page glossy photograph guide was a huge distraction. People who would otherwise book are now being sent down this content rabbit hole And then a few minutes in, their coffee is done, their dog starts barking, they got to go do something else, and they're gone. And that booking is gone. So that was a very instructive thing. And then on the positive side, there were some experiments which are examples of great product thinking, such as we started demoting the Airbnb hosts who were not being great on the marketplace. For example, they would just reject everyone. They would sit up there with attractive looking listings, but they would always just reject everyone or cause a lot of friction to book. We started steadily demoting them in the ranking and eventually removing them altogether. And that was a huge lift in bookings. Just for guests to be able to go on the marketplace and only see hosts who actively are going to say yes a lot, that was a huge lift. A lot of bookings came from that. And the kind of even more fun one was, it's probably my favorite one because it just demonstrates why infrastructure is so important. When I was there 5 years, 2012 to 2017, by far and away, the biggest impact was making it so that when you click on an Airbnb listing, it opens in a new tab. And that one little thing boosted bookings more than anything else. And it's funny because it seems so obvious in retrospect, but I tell you, the design team hated it. And a design-led company was not so easy to make happen, but you give an experiment infrastructure that lets anyone try stuff out, and then you show the metrics, and it just gets very hard to bite. So that was three different vignettes.
Yeah, I love the stories because I remember when I was at Amazon, I've seen the experiments when you do some small changes on the font, it can generate thousands of dollars, I think hundreds of millions of increase, something you don't understand. And then if you look at all the experiments, less than 50%, probably even fewer got launched. That means most of times our product intuitions are wrong. So for example, opening a new tab, it's interesting. I'm booking Airbnb right now. I really love this feature, but I also have 200 tabs open right now.
Yeah.
So when you work with designers or product managers, how do you interpret the results in their language to first convince them to run the test and then tell them what a launch decision looks like based on the statistical analysis?
Definitely. Well, the decision to run an experiment, usually the first thing is to just like convey how uncertain everything is. And so that, like anything else, if you're early in your experimentation journey and most people are skeptical, I would start with the early adopters, the people who are curious about this. Usually it's an AI team or a growth team are the ones who run experiments before anyone else for a variety of reasons we can get into. But suppose the company runs a lot of experiments, it's already established and you're trying to get some new employees on board. A great thing to talk about is like previous experiments you've run, kind of unintuitive answers you've seen. It can be from previous jobs as well, kind of just show them how this stuff works. And then just say, look, all we're going to do is do the same amount of work, but just wrap it in this experiment. And then we'll have so much learning to talk about on the other side.
Yeah.
In terms of how to interpret it and make decisions, there's a lot to go into there. And it gets into just, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, why are we even doing this product? So like, what are you hoping to happen? Getting people to clarify that can be like one of those sneaky benefits of running experimentation programs is just to enhance the rigor of your thinking.
Definitely want to talk more about rigorous thinking later. So a lot of times people think, oh, A/B testing is easy. You just look at the metrics. You can compare which metric is higher or lower. But there are a lot of challenges in A/B testing, a lot of nuances. So what makes experimentation difficult?
Yeah, experimentation is funny because it's both easy to intuit, right? You're basically divide people into equal groups and you see who outperforms another. But in practice, it can be a little bit more finicky and there can be some structural things you have to overcome. And there's a big reason why the Airbnbs and Netflixes and all invest a ton into their infrastructure to make it happen. So the first thing is there's a concept in experimentation called statistical power. And so the idea is you need a certain amount of data, a certain amount of sample size to be able to even notice that something's happening. I think people are sort of familiar with this idea. Like if you are trying to take an average, people know that if it's an average of like three things, it's like not much of an average compared to an average of 1,000 things. The same principle applies just at a kind of deeper level with experimentation, that you need a lot more data to detect things. And it's one of those where if it's a very large effect size, you might need less. If it's a smaller effect size, you might need more. But in the end, you just need enough data. So you have to run this thing called a power analysis to figure it out. There's a kind of this mathematical equation and needs some inputs. And that can be a little bit hard because there aren't really great off-the-shelf ways to do it. But it's super important, especially as you're starting out, because you're probably at more of a threshold where it may require waiting a long time to get enough data to finish an experiment. So that's step number one, is sample power analyses and statistical power. Another thing is when you are randomizing into 50-50 groups, how are you doing it? And is it a robust way? For example, you might think it's 50-50, but it's actually like 51%, 49%. It's slightly different. And it might seem like this trivial thing, but I tell you, every time there's been a meaningful difference in the splits, it's usually due to an actual issue where that 1% is a highly biased type, like your low latency users or your users on certain app versions that are broken or something like that. And so you have to run this thing called a sample ratio mismatch test to figure out, are the slight deviations from your expected randomization, is that due to chance or is that due to a real issue to look into? And then when you get into the actual implementation, one of the things that happens reliably as you start running experiments is you quickly realize your execution chops. For example, like once you get to a point you're running experiments, there's a lot of different use cases, a lot of different settings and contexts that people are using your app. And it might be wildly successful on some, but failing on others. For example, at Airbnb, we found all the time that we'd launch these experiments, which would look generally pretty positive, but they would be failing on Internet Explorer. Because at that stage, Internet Explorer had a bunch of issues, especially the older versions. Or it might be working everywhere except for East Asia because of how you handle time zones and stuff like that. So you'll quickly realize the diversity of your user base and the use cases. And that'll be something where it's not that the idea was bad. It's that you haven't really executed for the diversity that your application is serving. There's a lot more to that in terms of like using statistics properly. Like a lot of times people use very simple statistical methods like t-tests and Bayesian methods, which are kind of these fixed sample size tests, which are easy to implement. They have off-the-shelf tools for it, but they actually require some pretty strict adherence. You cannot stop experiments early. You're theoretically not even supposed to look at them until it's done. In practice, that's a very hard rule to follow, or where you're collaborating with business users. And so if you want to avoid the sort of false positive rate, like inflations that happen with it, then you end up needing to you need to follow the principles very closely. So in the end, there's quite a lot of things. I think I'm only like a third of the way through the list of potential failure modes of an experiment. But this is the goal of infrastructure, is to take care of a lot of that for you and make sure you don't have to know what you don't know.
Yeah. And data scientists, especially data science working on product and growth, is in an interesting position because a lot of times they don't report to a data science manager. They report to a product manager or report to engineering manager. Especially when they just join a new company or new team, some data scientists find it challenging to influence their teammates to set up the best practices. So what are some advice on set up experimentation best practices?
Yeah, well, I think a starting point is to always realize that any effort is done by a collection of humans. And so your ability to get people on the same page is going to lean on the strength of your relationships. So like anything else you do in the data world, there's basically no way to underinvest in human relationships. So start there. Then the second thing is we have to bring people along. The good news is that there's quite a lot of technical content out there on experimentation and statistics. Airbnb, Netflix, Amazon, Booking, everyone's writing quite a lot about it and people look up to those brands. So that's another good way to look at it. We publish quite a lot of technical content as well for this purpose, to arm people as they navigate there or to be able to get people on the same page with some of these concepts. And then a big part is setting expectations. There can be a bit of a whiplash of going from a world where you just kind of ship everything and throw it over the wall to one where you're carefully measuring it in a follow-up. And that measurement might show that it was a wild success they thought it was. It can be good for people to just understand what is going to come after and understand that the first launch might not be the wild success and it might be some follow-ups. And then the last mode, this is probably the thing I see most often messed up among companies. They start running experiments and they immediately want to take big swings. They want to go after the most public thing, the most visible, highly contentious project, because that's the one that ends up having the most doubt where people want to make sure it works. And that can be a bit of a failure mode. I think of all the things I just said before about why an experiment might fail that has nothing to do with the idea. The worst thing as a practice is if you do this big political fight to get people to run experiments, and then you just end up in this cloud of doubt about, did we even run the experiment properly? So I instead say, it's better to run a lot of small, lightweight experiments first. Build the muscle. Build it on low-stakes stuff. Build it on stuff that people understand and might not move a metric or not. Among there, you're probably going to come across some wins. You'll probably have something to celebrate. And then by the point you go after something more public or visible, you have confidence in the infrastructure, you have some basic knowledge of how this stuff works and what the check and the failure modes.
Yeah, I like that. Maybe start with changing some font or the color of the button.
Totally. Like that. when I work with companies, as part of EPO, we often do quite a lot of support. And what we like to do is give them a list of 10 experiments which you just green light right away. And it's usually very small stuff. It's like adding badges or, again, adjusting fonts, adjusting layout very slightly. It's stuff that theoretically some front-end engineer can just do by themselves. It doesn't require that.
Yeah. Before I worked on A/B testing, I wouldn't believe changing some color, even just one shade of a button or from a squared to like a rounded would change revenue. But I've seen it myself. So it's really fascinating to work in the field.
Totally. I mean, every company's got crazy stories like that. I know I wasn't at Microsoft and working on Bing, but I'd heard that Bing is something that's in Ronnie Kohavi's book. But like in Bing, it turns out if you like take the sort of text that's part of what the ad is going to say and you have it like wrap around instead of dot, dot, dot or something like that, then it was like a 10% boost in revenue. It was some like absurd amount.
Yeah.
And so these small changes can lead to big effects. The one thing I would say is that when we say button colors and font changes, I think people just sort of roll their eyes and be like, what are we even doing here? The key thing is small changes can have big effects. And you should care about metrics in general, so it should matter. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, it can lead to big learnings. I mean, think of that listing a new tab thing. Of course, it's great that it boosted metrics and it's awesome. But the big takeaway is that not losing search context matters. Mm. If you're midway through a search and you get distracted or something, you need to pick up where you left off. It's very helpful to have those tabs open. It's kind of helpful to have to be able to pick up where you left off. And you can see a lot of product work coming out of that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in Airbnb, you also worked on search ranking. You worked on fraud detection. So what made you want to later work on A/B testing, or were there any connection there?
Yeah, I think the big thing with experimentation was we just saw the whole culture of Airbnb. And again, this is a place that's led by designers, like start to just really lean on experimentation. And it led to just some incredible moments. For example, most companies in hypergrowth mode, they grow very fast, but at a decreasing rate. So Airbnb, we grew like 3x, 3x, 2.8x, 2.6x, it was steadily decreasing. But we actually reinflected the growth. We actually made that growth rate go up again. And because we ran the experiments, we had the receipts of why. And it was a bunch of the work that was happening on this kind of search marketplace team, you know. So that was just very telling. Like it's pretty rare in a tech company to both reinflect the growth that way and have that sort of clarity on like what it was doing. And that led to a place where suddenly every team at Airbnb was being measured on how many bookings they drove. And how do you know how many bookings that team drove? Well, they ran experiments. Mm-hmm. And so it just really dramatically changed the culture in a way that I thought was awesome. And I think what's most compelling about that culture change, the thing that kind of really got me to build EPO was it just enabled this entrepreneurial spirit where suddenly you could try stuff out without having to win big political battles. You could put something out there, put it in front of customers, see how they like it. And that ended up being a great fit for Airbnb. You didn't have to be a data person to love the idea that like, here's an atmosphere, a culture where people are empowered to try stuff out. You don't have to like win over like high powered people with your charisma or whatever. You can get it in front of customers and see what they think.
Yeah.
So very few things a data team can do that will like change a culture, like experimentation.
Yeah. And I also talked to a friend working as a machine learning engineer at Meta, and he said he wished more engineers know more about A/B testing, because a lot of people focusing on offline metrics like accuracy, precision, and recall. But when you launch a model in production, it's completely different. You have to think about, do people actually use your model? Do they click on it? Do they like it? Customer satisfaction. So what are some advice on testing machine learning models?
Yeah, I mean, test everywhere, test often. The basic advice. I mean, you said it perfectly. Like me, on search ranking, we saw that like every model we put out there looked great on the offline simulations on this sort of local development setting. Something like 20% of them actually moved the metric. There's just a bunch of reasons why that'd be different. I mean, basically your offline data isn't quite representative as your online data. You have people reacting to your thing. that can lead to different situations, especially in the fraud world where you have adversarial context. It's a very different world. So the basic answer is, in a way, you probably want to experiment infra before you even have ML infra, because like you can do things like linear regressions and make slight improvements to linear regressions, and that can move metrics. And then you would know it if you have an A/B test thing. So I would say every time you are adjusting a model in production, whether that's adding a new feature, trying a different architecture, in the case of next gen AI, generative AI stuff, if you're using like an open source model versus an open AI model or something that's more tailor-made to a vertical versus otherwise, A/B testing is how you're going to know whether it's the juice is worth the squeeze, whether it has ROI, whether the metrics are moving, and thus it's worth paying up for this other model.
Yeah. So when people are testing their machine learning models, what kind of metrics do you recommend when they run A/B tests?
Well, the big thing is business. You want to use business metrics. One of the things that happens with AI and ML teams is that there's quite a lot of political backing and excitement when you first get the model up. The first time you move to a search ranking model as opposed to some heuristic, or the first time you get a Gen AI feature. And that can be exciting and something you have this ML team. But if you want to justify further investment, once you're talking about iterating on the existing model, that's something that can be very hard for an organization to feel the difference. Think of something like Airbnb search ranking or pricing Airbnb or recommendations or whatever. Your new model might have taken an enormous amount of effort in feature engineering and offline evaluations and stuff. To a business user or to a customer, it looks identical in product. It's just your search ranking models now returning a different set of 20 things versus the original set of 20 things. Your pricing recommendations is also just spitting a number out. Yeah. And so it can be very hard for an organization to feel like, over there, I have this team that is like materially changing the product in like noticeable visual ways. And over here, I have this ML team, which costs a lot. It's high expertise work and can feel like it's just doing musical chairs around. But when you run the experiments, if you do it against business metrics, if you do it against stuff that is the language of a business user, the language of a CFO, then you end up in this magical world where you can make your cases against all the other teams of, this is why this stuff is worth investing in. This is why we need more tools to be more productive. This is why ML and AI as a direction is like very important for the company. So this is a big thing where ML teams can be trapped in this world where everything makes sense from an operator perspective, but it's just hard to put in conversation with any other investment that a company might make. And A/B experimentation is really what brings you out of the darkness there.
Yeah. And I think in our previous conversation, you mentioned we should put A/B testing in part of the MLOps process.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this is something where if you just look at any kind of production AI practice, whether it's at Netflix or Meta or Google or whatever, they are running A/B tests after every model iteration. And so it just becomes part of MLOps. This is something that I think most people kind of intuitively know, but it doesn't get said as much. It's just A/B experimentation is MLOps. It's just the last stage of a model's life cycle, from data set curation to offline training, offline evaluation, and then production eval, AKA A/B experiments.
Yeah, and you learn so much about your customer that helps you build better model and collect better data as well. So after Airbnb, you become an early employee in another company again. What made you want to make the change?
Yeah, I really loved that kind of 100, 200 person stage. Airbnb, when I joined, was 200 people or so. And by the time I left, it was like 5,000 or so. It was just so big. It was very, very big. So it's just a different world. And so I feel like I had learned a lot about what kind of data team do to drive impact quickly. And I was excited to try it out again at different places. So I did some consulting, I worked at some places, and then eventually with Webflow, I was the second data scientist there. And that was cool because it was a SaaS business. Airbnb is an actual marketplace and going to a SaaS business. And one of the things you learn as a data team is that your job and the makeup of your team changes by the business model. SaaS metrics are very different than marketplace metrics. Marketing-led growth is different than product-led growth. And so it was cool to bring that playbook into a different setting. And I ended up rebuilding the same Airbnb experimentation infrastructure there. And that was definitely taught me a lot about a kind of 0-to-1 on that type of infra. And I was supporting the marketing arm quite a lot for lifecycle metrics and optimizing a lot of their campaigns.
Oh, nice. So for folks who are not really familiar with marketplace business versus SaaS business, Can you give us some examples? What are, in terms of metrics, what kind of metrics do you use for those type of businesses?
Totally. So marketplaces are typically the one metric that rules them all is transactions. Marketplace clearing. In the case of Airbnb, it's like people making a booking. In the case of eBay, people making a purchase. Marketplaces, they usually monetize some fee off a transaction, and that ends up being the main metrics you want to lift. And that has really nice properties because many marketplaces clear fairly fast. So your metrics bear fruit very quickly. They align customer goals with company goals very well. So you can nakedly pursue that metric and know that you're also helping the customer for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so it, from a data team's perspective, it's sort of on easy mode in my mind, because like your value system of establishing a data empirical based value system of saying we care about this metric going up and thus we should do all these things is very easy in the marketplace. Once you get to a SaaS company, typically the most important metric is ARR, annual recurring revenue, number of subscriptions, that sort of stuff. And so Webflow was a kind of monthly subscription, swipe a credit card type of deal. And it's great as a business model because recurring subscription money is a nice stable thing. You can grow nice businesses and it's very easy to turn into some large outcomes. But as a data team, it can be a little challenging because a customer's desire, like signing up for a subscription that they don't end up canceling, is only correlated with customers benefiting from using the product. So in the case of Webflow, like the reason people use Webflow is to make a website. And so I was establishing a lot of metrics around, did someone get a website up and running that was getting traffic? Because that actually fulfilled the promise of Webflow. And if someone upgraded their subscription, but they did not get a website live, they tended to churn over time. Like it's very rare that they actually continued staying subscribed. So you could get some money from them, but that wasn't the customer value thing. And so that was the pivot. And making these types of metrics and figuring out what represents customer value when the money metric is only correlated, that's a bit of a challenge for the data team. It's a very interesting challenge. I think I have a lot of thoughts on how someone might go about it, but a very different mode than a marketplace business.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And you're the second data scientist. So how do you scale experimentation there?
Yeah, that was much, much more challenging. So at Airbnb, we had a couple of benefits. One, that there was a lot of just straight up PhDs like lying around. You know, they're very high expertise people and who are used to statistical methods and probabilistic uncertainty and stuff like that. And even if they weren't, there's a lot of engineers who came from Facebook or came from Google or something. And so even without a lot of prior experimentation having happened, there was still just a lot of latent desire for it. And people understood just how to do it. In contrast, at Webflow, I'm pretty sure I was the first person there who had any experimentation background. And so there was a huge education gap. There were no PhDs lying around. There was no kind of big growth culture or AI culture or anything like that to work off of. And so we were standing up the growth team, running these first sets of experiments. And so I built the Airbnb system there. I learned a lot about kind of what extends, what doesn't. The good news is that core architecture extends to SaaS businesses, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. But the problem I ran into was all the support, all of the questions of how do I interpret this thing? Yep. Did I set it up properly? How long do I run it? How do I interpret these stats? And so I started really entering into my head that a great experimentation infrastructure would not just deliver capabilities, it would deliver confidence. It would deliver like a feeling like I know what to make of this and I trust it. And so that's really what's kind of I've built into Eppo, is to say, how can you have the Airbnb culture without having to hire all those PhDs? You have a system that not only has all the power of the Airbnb system, but it'd have a lot of very intentional design so that you as a business user kind of know, should I trust this report? Is it ready to read? And if it's ready to read, how should I make a decision?
Yeah, I can really resonate with the confidence part, because when I was at Amazon, we have a tool. It shows the direction. I think it shows some information how to interpret the results. But as the experimentation team, we still host regular office hours, and product managers and engineers will come to get advice from us. And we even have training called bar raisers. I was a bar raiser, so we can give the team some more confidence. Yeah, thanks. Whether you can launch decision or not. And sometimes when they, it's interesting when someone has a really good results, they never question the data quality. And yes. When they have bad results, I was, oh, can you check whether randomization works? Are there any missing data, etc.? As a barrister, you have to explain things to them and convince them this is not a good decision. So when a company doesn't have, like you mentioned, a lot of PhDs or in this case, bar raisers, how can you provide a rigorous answer to someone using an experimentation tool when they see a bunch of metrics and different colors?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of directions here. So the first is we just kind of go like one by one through all the common failure modes of experimentation and just try to come up with intentional design that's going to work if you're not a bar raiser. For example, those common traffic imbalance checks, sample ratio mismatch checks. So we automate those and we'll send you an alert proactively in your Slack that says like there's an issue here. Other things, in terms of the statistical power conversation, we have these out of the box like statistical power tools, but even if you don't use them, every experiment in EPPO has a progress bar, which is kind of a mental model that works for business people. It's like, I don't have to really know the details of how you came up with the idea that we are 75% done. I understand that we're 75% done and I need to wait. So what's great is with EPPO is like you can just lean on our kind of off-the-shelf power analysis tools to say like you want to see a certain effect size and we can observe your data and see that you need to wait longer. Or suppose you're just saying, I want to run it for 2 weeks, they can enter that in. And so you're enabling kind of this self-serve guidance of how long do I need to wait? And then another big thing I'm very passionate about is experimentation has to live on as a data platform. It has to inherit all the same dependencies of data platform that all your other data systems do. And that means it sits on top of the warehouse and all those pipelines better work. Now, as you and I both know, especially in a kind of, any company, but especially startups, the data pipelines often don't work. Sometimes they break. Yeah. And sometimes there's like data deviations, data movement, data drift. And so we take that stuff seriously. So a lot of experimentation tools wipe their hands of it and say it's part of some other system's fault. We basically build in some lightweight observability tools and anomaly detection tools into EPPO to say like, we have not noticed any data in the past few days. Read the report. It's not ready. You need to fix the pipeline. Or there's some kind of anomaly under the hood. Other things that I've seen people get tripped up on are outliers. Every business I've ever worked in has outliers, all of them.
Yeah.
And so these are these data points that are like many deviations from the mean in a way that's anomalous. Another way of saying it is, I don't know if your listeners have listened to The Black Swan by Nassim Taleb.
Yeah.
The general gist is the most distributions in the real world follow power laws, which have really heavy tails and lead to these crazy outliers that will sway an entire experiment. So just the removal of that data point will actually completely change your interpretation of the entire experiment. And so this is something that happened at Webflow, happened at Airbnb. And what we do is we out of the box will Windsorize things, kind of clip it at the 99.9th percentile and just kind of take away these like incredibly impactful outliers by just kind of capping the value. And then we use a statistical method called Cupid, which has a lot of benefits in terms of speeding up experiments, but it also helps with this outlier problem. And so there's a long list of stuff, but what we try to say is like experimentation is a collaboration of engineering, business users, and data. What is data's responsibility? It's to supply the correct data and the correct definitions. So we create a kind of a metric library type of experience where data people can input the correct definitions and maintain them easily, govern them as the company grows. For engineers, they are setting up these experiments with SDKs, and hopefully you're enabling in your company engineers to run experiments end to end all on their own. And so they need to be able to navigate systems and make decisions even without statistical decrease. And then business users, they're usually socializing and stuff all around the org. They want to celebrate their team's accomplishments and they want to explain their learnings. So they need interfaces that not only that they understand, not only that this PM understands, but that PM can communicate to others, can put up on the board in the middle of the product meeting and have everyone get the right takeaway. Mm-hmm. So a long sequence of failure modes that we try to mitigate, be proactively and communicate around, while also enabling each member of this collaboration to do their best, most powerful work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I like that in EPPO, you have a split by feature where you can filter the samples and dive deeper into one segment and see the impact on new users and old users. So in my experience, we have to write custom queries. So every time when the product manager have a new assumption, because they always have a lot of new assumptions and you dive deeper into data. So I feel this will improve data science productivity. But I have a question. So when we recommend in the decision-making process, we recommend team to only focus on 2-3 metrics. We want them to think about the metrics they have defined before they start experiments. And sometimes when they discover something interesting after the experiments, they want to change the goalposts. And we call this cherry picking metrics. So how do you think people should best use this feature and not to cherry pick metrics?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. I think this is part of what I was getting at, where there's some benefits of experimentation of making people encode their thinking of how they make decisions. Mm-hmm. No, I think this is something where infrastructure can really play a role, where there are some things where you do have to check all these metrics. We call them guardrail metrics, right? I'll just use the Airbnb example again. Like, mm-hmm. of course you want to improve bookings, but you don't want to spike customer support tickets or cancellations or just something that is like a downstream bad thing. If you are some e-com business, you of course want to increase the number of purchases, but you don't want to increase the rate of returns, and you want to make sure your margin is good. So there'll be a bunch of these metrics which truly matter to the business, and you do want to track all of them. And so it can be a little bit of a shape of a try to improve this primary metric, but make sure the others like don't move, at least don't get worse. But what people often do is try to come up with some way down the list, like not that important metric, and call that as a basis of victory. Our attitude at Eppo, I've finally been able to build the system that I wanted for this, which is you can create this decisioning space that allows a center of excellence to be a little bit opinionated, where every experiment might have a bespoke primary metric, the main thing they're trying to move. And then they'll have the guardrail metrics. But all the other metrics you're trying to read, they are going to be in a separate section. As you do all these split buys, like you can look at those numbers, but they're not going to be on the primary decisioning space. They're going to be in another section of the app. So basically what we want to do is we want to let people do investigations, get curious, find explanations, but not pollute the decisioning space with it. And so this is how infrastructure can help. But of course, this is also a cultural organizational problem. And I think as an org, if you sit down and say, here's generally how we think experimentation decisions should go, and you socialize, that can be a good way to enforce some systemic rigor, some idea of here's our opinion about how experiments should be done. Yeah. So we very much encourage both infra to do its job and organizations to also be somewhat opinionated about what they want in their decisioning process.
Yeah, I like that. So using this feature, Sleep By, to dive deeper into your current experimentation, to get curious, learn something, it can help you form new assumptions. And then with a new assumption, you can run a new experiment to test it separately, but not pollute your current analysis.
Exactly. And it's especially true once you're socializing and stuff around the org, you're sending it to your chief product officer or something. Like that's where you can see some shenanigans, right? That's where people just sneak in all sorts of stories. If you have infrastructure that delivers somewhat opinionated reports, just the consistency of that can really help here. Because then it's like, you're sending me these numbers in Slack. Can you just show me the thing? Show me the report? And that kind of puts you on some guardrails. I think that's part of how you can get there.
Yeah. Another thing I worked on when I was at Amazon was to help data scientists, engineers from different teams to onboard their own metrics, because the main metrics around purchase, but think about audiobooks and Prime Video, they care about different things. And in beginning, it takes some time for them to onboard metrics on the central A-B testing experimentation. So do you have something that make it easy for customers from different industries to onboard their own metrics?
Totally. I mean, metric management is like one of the big, big things that we tend to excel at. And I think part of it is that there's some nuance to metrics in a large organization, right? So you call that one thing, which is there are multiple business units who have their own goals and they have a set of core metrics and they want to be aware of how all the other teams are affecting their metric. For example, if you're at Airbnb, there might be a business travel team and they care very, very closely. They look very, very closely at the business travel bookings. That's their metric. And then you'll have some other thing that's about like family bookings, and they want to know how many family bookings there are. And so you need the ability to have different businesses and code their metrics. But, and so we definitely make that a very easy thing for every team to kind of add their metrics and certify them and lock them down. But there's a separate problem in experimentation that I feel like everyone feels but haven't been able to articulate much, which is there are core important metrics that really matter that need to be locked down. And usually you put their definitions in GitHub. You version control them. Only a center of excellence really gets to change them with some certification structure. But then there's all these other metrics which are just sort of ad hoc and exploratory. Like, you don't even know if you're going to use this metric definition for too long. It just is sort of relevant for this one experiment or for this one quarter. Or maybe you are considering spinning up a business travel team and you want them to operate with a certain metric, but it hasn't been fully greenlit as like anything more than a Tiger team. Mm-hmm. And so what can often happen is if you're the only metrics you can view in infrastructure are the lockdown certified GitHub controlled thing, you just start to see that library balloon. Like just all these little ad hoc things which have very short lifetimes end up going through a very long certification process, often taking multiple days or a week or two, just to be able to review the result in the platform. So I feel like good infrastructure needs to acknowledge that there are some core lockdown things. And then there are some exploratory ones that eventually graduate into the lockdown things. And you need a path for the exploratory ones to be spun up fast and the lockdown ones to be not touched too often and to be tightly governed and controlled.
Yeah. And in my past experience, A/B testing sounds like something data scientists do, but it's actually a team sport. We rely on engineers to writing code to kind of embed their algorithm into the experimentation. And some challenges I'm seeing is sometimes because they don't know a lot about statistics, sample, sometimes the way they filter their sample before the experiment get triggered, causing some issues in randomization. And then downstream, data scientists analyze the results and the report to product manager. And there's also some knowledge gap there that make decisions. So I'm curious, who's using Apple? Is it engineers, data scientists, or product managers? And how do you bridge those skill gaps?
Yes, all three. I think one of the big things we have said about this industry is that experimentation is a collaboration business. Experimentation is a collaboration tool, not just like a dev tool. And I think part of it goes into this intentional design where if you think of an experiment as like a kind of canvas that gets added to as these layers get added on, sometimes there's a long planning process and you have PMs like writing up hypotheses and writing up Notion docs and outlining how they're going to make a decision, and that all gets encoded in before you've set up anything. Sometimes it's just an engineer just spinning something up and just using the off-the-shelf metrics. But if you just have this surface area that's meant to be collaborated on and highly public, you can have these multiple starting points, but the PMs, the data people, the engineers, everyone's socialized to like how to interact with this thing.
Yeah. This whole conversation reminded me so many stories and experiences I had. I think another thing about A/B experimentation in a large organization is every team tests their experiment in silo. Even if you're in the same team, one product manager testing something, learn something, the other product manager might not know this. So I used to look at all the results and then write a report, share the learning and also the failure to the entire company. So different teams have visibility of what other teams are testing and they can get inspired by that. I'm curious, in Apple, do you have something like that to help teams learn from each other?
Yeah, 100%. It's one of the things that comes with centralization. There's some companies that they grow up and they get into experimentation, but they let every pod run with their own infrastructure. And that has this like issue where you no longer get that pooling of knowledge and awareness, where you no longer have this place where you can say, like, here's all the experiments going on. And I can like understand how that business unit is affecting my metric, or what have we learned about experimenting this area historically? There's less of that ability to like index and build up a knowledge base. So I think to be able to centralize across multiple businesses, business units, across multiple teams, you kind of need the architecture to do it, which kind of gets into how you model metrics and what you choose to centralize, what you choose to decentralize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At Epo, we made this conscious decision that we want to strongly centralize analysis and metrics, because no business units should be redefining what revenue is or redefining what a purchase is, but decentralizing setup. Because people might have a variety of flagging tools. They might have a variety of setup tools. Maybe they're randomizing completely offline in an Excel sheet and just kind of uploading it into some Redis cluster or something and randomizing using that. There are a variety of ways in which you can get there. Maybe they're using a machine learning system and that is handling randomization. Mm-hmm. So decentralizing the setup while centralizing the analysis was a kind of way you get there in centralization. And then once you centralize the analysis, that's the natural place where kind of reports get curated, knowledge learning happens, and knowledge gets disseminated. And it's a really natural place to build a knowledge base off of, where now you can like index all those findings, you can disseminate them, share them out in Slack or email or Notion or whatever. And if anyone was ever to join the company and they wanted to see, has anyone tried experimenting on the onboarding flow or whatever, you now have a place you can figure that out.
Yeah. And I think one thing about experimentation is it helps data and product team learn a lot of things about their customers. Another thing is to finally help them make decisions. However, most of the experimentation doesn't, they won't have significant results. That's another thing I learned. Only a small portion of them will. And then the product manager will lean on you to help them still make a decision. So when the result is inconclusive, how do you make decisions? Because we cannot just test the same thing over and over again, right? And sometimes you just don't get that many users and you don't reach that statistical power.
Totally, totally. And this is something, when I first joined Webflow, they had run an experiment before, but they didn't have the knowledge of what's required to do it. And so they used the somewhat naive way of randomizing using like the last digit of the user ID, which is a fine way to start. You know, mm-hmm. But when they did the analysis, it was in some ways sort of a sad story. There was this product that I thought was like actually a pretty good product, had some good research behind it. And I was an ex-Webflow user and I thought it would be pretty compelling. They ran it as an experiment and it didn't move any metrics. And everyone got very sad. They kind of ended up like disbanding the effort, disbanding the team, assigning them to other stuff. And when I joined, it had happened about a month before I joined. They asked me to take a look at it and I looked at it and I was like, this thing had, like they ran it for like a few days or a week. It needed to run for like a month and a half. Like it was nowhere close to enough data. Like there was no way you were going to detect anything. Like this is sort of what I was getting in terms of these failure modes, is that there can be a huge issue where you internalize that something didn't work, but it's really just that you didn't handle all these failure modes and now bad institutional knowledge had been created. So yeah, it's both important to be able to look into the past to like see what's happened, see what's been tested and see whether it worked. But it's also important that if your infrastructure is good, you can introspect, was it even a good experiment? Was it set up properly? Mm. Like what were, not just that you tested on the onboarding flow, but what were the screenshots of what you put in there? And was that actually well-founded? This is a big part of what a good kind of knowledge generating system should be doing.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned something very interesting. The experiment was terminated too early. And I know some companies want to have a holdout set to test a long-term effect. I think there's a pros and cons of it, because if you're testing a customer online behavior, sometimes people clear their cookies or different type of logins, maybe share accounts. So what do you think about running those long-term experiments, having a holdout set?
Yeah, it's a great topic. I'm a big believer in holdouts. They're a great gold standard for understanding a program's entire set of effects. So if you launch like 10 experiments and you want to see what is the total additive effect, these holdouts are great for that. They're really good for understanding a team's entire impact. But the problem is that only a few companies are really going to be able to accomplish them. And it has very little to do with the infrastructure. Like Epo, we can help people set up holdouts. We have a holdout feature. But the problem that happens is, one, if you don't have large data volume and you do some sort of 1% holdout or something, or like 2.5% holdout, like that is just not going to add up to a lot of data in the end.
Yeah.
Like, it's just going to be so small that you're not really going to detect anything. The second problem is what you're mentioning, where like holdouts basically don't work on cookie-based assignments. like anything where cookies get wiped, where your metrics at a user level and you have the identity resolution, like it's very hard for it to work there. And then the third problem is that holdouts, if you're going to have some version of your code that's going to be kept aside for a long stretch of time, that's a lot of feature flags you're keeping open. And it can be very hard to kind of cast a version of the application in Amber and have it still be workbook free.
Yeah.
Because you need no use of doing a comparison if like that version of the application is just has bugs in it. And so that can be very hard for a team to accomplish. You see some of the larger organizations like Meta, who like are very config driven in their development and everything, like they are able to do these holdouts, but for a lot of other companies, it can be hard to accomplish. So we encourage people to use holdouts if they are ready to get everyone, get a large effort, a large engineering effort on board to do it. But if you are unable to do it, there's some other options of how you might get similar goals accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So have holdouts is good to measure long-term effects. And for short-term effects, I know some companies and teams are running multi-unbanded testing. So how do you decide when to run A-B test versus MAB?
Yeah, bandits are super interesting. So for anyone in your audience who doesn't know what a multi-unbanded are, the gist is an A-B test, you keep these even splits, like 50-50 for, you know, a month, and then you're going to make a decision to launch one of them. With a multi-unbanded, you automate the decision-making such that suppose a week into the test, you notice that one of the variations are doing better than the other. You start shifting traffic to the winner. And then so long as that winner keeps winning, you continue to shift the traffic over there. And so it has this nice benefit that you can start reaping the rewards earlier. So you don't have to wait the 1 month to start pushing treatments to the winner. It also has this benefit in that it's sort of automated. In a world where people feel uncomfortable with making decisions on experiments, it feels like this get the humans out of it sort of thing. But the problem is that bandits in practice are actually very finicky. Most people use multiple metrics and they make a decision. It's not just the one thing. They have these trade-offs. And once you are in many metric world, then bandits don't converge so well.
Yeah.
They're somewhat more unstable. And then the other issue is that they're not really optimal for the business other than a few certain situations. For example, another way to think about A/B tests is that they're an explore and exploit process. You are maximally exploring for the 1 month in which you're doing 50-50, and then you're going to exploit it indefinitely. Forever forward, you're going to use that winner and get all the metrics improved. A bandit is basically saying we want to start exploiting during the exploration phase. And that's important if in certain circumstances where there's a big time opportunity cost. For example, if you have a Black Friday deal, there's no benefit to your winner after Black Friday. Once Black Friday is come and gone, it doesn't matter what was the winner because all your benefits are up until then. Another thing would be a news headline. Suppose you have 3 sets of copy for a news headline. Once that news is passe, the World Cup or something, and the World Cup's done, then there are no more benefits of that news, a more optimal news headline. And so those are circumstances for which bandits are great. They're really good because you want to start reaping your rewards with enough time to benefit from them. But the vast majority of testing out there is not of that shape. It's actually something where you can reap the rewards of the winner for indefinitely. And in that case, it's just much better to do the explorer stage optimally. And 50-50 splits are way better than anything else for the explorer stage.
Yeah. And now a lot of people are talking about AI, large language models. So what does AI mean for data scientists?
I think it means an incredible amount for us. I'm there for a variety of reasons. One is that data folks kind of are naturally positioned to be able to be a big part of making those products. These are, even though a lot of the foundational models are kind of giving you a lot off the shelf, the type of data you're feeding into them, if you do any amount of local training or is kind of a data process that you're going to be naturally part of. But the second big thing is that AI, we talked about machine learning before and why people run so many experiments, why AI experimentation is part of the MLOps workflow. The same thing is true of AI products, where the second you put an AI product out there, you're going to start running a lot of A/B experiments and you're going to start driving a very metrics-oriented point of view. So suddenly you're going to start deciding that products are successful by whether they move these metrics or not, which naturally makes a lot of people reach out to the data team for consultation, for investment, for advice. And once metrics are a key part of decision-making, then suddenly it's worth investing in data quality. It's worth investing in data scientist productivity. A lot of stuff comes out of that. So it's going to mean quite a lot. And if I'm to really prognosticate into the future, put on my tinfoil hat, so to speak, I think this is going to do a lot for data teams at an even deeper level, where the things we have noticed so far about Gen AI, it's early days, but the things we've noticed so far is that we are going to speed up the process of ideation, because ChatGPT is very good at brainstorms. It's very good at generating ideas. If you want to just spit out 10 ideas, you can just ask ChatGPT, it'll do it. We are also going to speed up the development of creative assets. Suddenly, you can just ask Runway to give you like 100 different creative assets along with you, and you have 100 different things to evaluate. And we're also going to see the speed of software development rapidly speed up, because GitHub Copilot is going to enable people to develop much more quickly, and for kind of people with less sophisticated software backgrounds to do some amount of programming. And so in every which way, we're going to start to see just the cost of implementing ideas go to zero, just go down tremendously. And if the cost of implementing ideas goes down a ton, then the bottleneck becomes evaluating ideas.
Yeah.
How do you pick the winners of them? If you have 100 creative assets, which one's the winner? If you have 5 different potential growth experiments going out, like which ones are driving value and which ones are actively detrimental? This, again, just pushes on the data team. Because that, you know, we're talking about evaluation. That is basically what the data team lives for.
Yeah. And I think now I hear two voices. One is people saying, oh, data scientists are going to be out of their jobs because of AI tools. And then there's that another voice saying, with different new tools, there are different problems to solve, there are new opportunities, and you still need data scientists to customize solution, define the business problem. So what's your take on this?
It's hard to say exactly where tools and people are going to jump into here, but I do believe that data as an evaluation process is going to be a much bigger thing. Now, it's true, I think we are going to see some AI tools that are going to make it that maybe you're not typing SQL very much. Yeah. Maybe you're leaning on some other tools to actually generate these queries. But one of the things is that I think across the board, we might see leaner teams, but the magnitude, the importance of the function is just going to increase.
Yeah, maybe we'll have leaner team, but there are more data teams because we don't have the barrier to entry anymore. It's so easy to set it up
because
there's always things to measure.
Totally, because one of the things that I don't want to ever say AI will never be able to do this, but something I think that AI will struggle with is defining correct canonical metrics. Because if you think of what does it take to do the entire transformations to come up with what exactly is an Airbnb booking confirmation, it's a lot of very bespoke local stuff, right? AI is very good at taking general knowledge and applying it, stuff that's out there on the internet. If it's something like this particular code base and the history of this code base, and especially code across services, so it's not even in one code base, had a bunch of very bespoke decisions that created weird artifacts that have to be untangled by your data engineers.
Right.
That is something I think AI might have trouble with. And that's something where I think for a long time data teams will be doing. Now, everything from the moment of creating canonical tables, clean artifacts that can be reused, that is something where I think tools and AI will plug into, at least of all EPO. Like, you know, a big part of what we're doing is sitting on top of those artifacts and giving you an experimentation culture. So I see data teams becoming more and more in the weeds on developing clean artifacts and more consultative, high level consultative on everything that follows.
Yeah. So you worked at two companies in their early stage when you were a data scientist. And I'm sure you worked with engineers, leaders, product leaders. So you're not just doing data science. You have to communicate and sell your solutions. So how do you develop those communication skills?
Yeah, it's so important. So important. I think that one of the things about working in data is you should figure out, are you on are you in the business of building production systems, like an ML engineer or something like that, or a data infrastructure engineer? Are you on that sort of path, in which case your career might look more like an IC engineer type? Or are you in the path of influence? Are you trying to change decisions in the business? Are you trying to get people to invest in a certain area to drive a roadmap? Stuff that might look more like a PM or a marketer if you're doing marketing related work or et cetera. If you're on the path of influence, it's good to just embrace it and not continue to treat yourself as like an engineer. Like I see a lot of kind of like analytics engineer types who like they give that title and they lean into the engineer word and not into the analyst word, where they need like it's not enough to just spin up a dashboard and just say, hey, everyone self-serve off the dashboard. The dashboard was created to drive a certain agenda, and you need to pursue that agenda, which means winning hearts and minds. How do you win hearts and minds? Well, there's the best way is to invest in relationships. The best way to invest in relationships is to help, be a sincere helper, help people do their jobs. Make it so that every time you're collaborating with them, they know you are here to help. You're going to help them do their job. You're going to be an asset, which comes in a lot of different ways. But the good thing about being a data person is that it's very easy to be helpful for people. People always need more data.
Yeah. And you mentioned analytics engineer. In Apple's website, also saw you have statistics engineer. So how's that? What is that role? And how's it different from a statistician?
Yeah, we made it up. It was a fun moment of branding because we feel at Apple that there's a certain type of engineer. If you're one of them, Apple is the best place in the world to work. And what it is, we do some of the most advanced statistical methods in the world. I think even in this young stage, we've been able to drive the agenda of experimentation practices at very high-powered places. But we are also a software application, we're infrastructure, which means that it's not enough to know the statistical methods and prototype them in a Jupyter notebook. You have to submit production code. You need to create the capabilities for the whole world. And so what we needed were people who were able to submit production code, but also know statistics well. And that de facto means either you're a great software engineer who knows and likes stats, or you're a great statistician who knows enough coding to contribute. In a way, I feel like it's a bit of a throwback. When data science first emerged at places like LinkedIn and Facebook and places like that, it had a whole lot of people who like knew stats, but were fundamentally still engineers. I feel like as the tooling got better and we didn't have to like manually write MapReduce jobs in Java or whatever, and it became something more SQL oriented, it started to become more data analyst oriented, which is good because, again, if you want to drive a roadmap and an agenda, that's a different skill set. But this is a bit of a throwback to the old world of data science, of saying like, what are the people who are great at building and also deeply understand the methods? Because if you're one of those people, like Apple is just an incredible place for you.
Yeah. And so you joined two early stage startups. So how do you know they're going to be successful later? Were you lucky or did you have a strategy?
Yeah, Airbnb is definitely luck. That one was, I was early in my career, so I didn't know too much about how to evaluate companies, much less something that turned into like the behemoth that it became. That's a funny story about Airbnb. Part of the reason I joined is I had a friend who worked there and we were going to meet up at a bar in San Francisco. Yeah. And so I thought I was just meeting him. So I just showed up there and then he shows up on a bus that has been decorated in themes like the Beatles. It's called the Magical Mystery Bus. Mm-hmm. And he comes off of it with all of Airbnb into this bar. And everyone's just in this ridiculous mood and just basically takes over the bar. And it was just like Airbnb was such a special culture. It was so adventurous and quirky and weird and just like very empathetic and fun. And so just hearing the culture and then hearing about the problems, at that point, Airbnb had just gotten big enough where fraudsters were coming after them, which is, a big moment of becoming big league. And so they needed someone who could create all these machine learning models to predict fraud. And so it was a nice moment, a cool technical problem and a great culture. And so I joined it and then became to realize how powerful it is to work in the travel industry, to work at a place that has big international network effects and is asset light and all these benefits. Now, joining other startups, I think if you were to join now, I think the big thing you have to figure out is, are you joining a company that has product market fit or not? If it doesn't have product market fit, and I'm kind of paraphrasing the founder of Posthog, who I admire, who for his tweets about this, but if a company does not have a product market fit, they should be keeping pretty lean, being exploratory, getting their way to product market fit with a small, tight team that is capital efficient. Once you are at product market fit, that is when you can be somewhat more aggressive and pursue a growth strategy. And that is about seizing as much of the market as you can. And so when you look at these companies, you have to, like, one, figure out where they are in their journey. If they do have product market fit, then you better figure out, like, what is the size of the market they're operating under? How big can this thing be? And kind of what is my role in it? So that's some kind of simple things about how to evaluate companies.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And when you think about your previous experiences, what are some mistakes you made in your career?
Let's see. I think part of things in my career was that early on in Airbnb, I came there and I was having a lot of fun and working on some of these problems. But there was probably much more I could have done to try to rise up management tracks. I think, for example, in the data world, I think there's this kind of issue where there's not really such a thing as, like, a principal IC data scientist. It's not like engineering in that way. Yeah. And so to kind of rise up a data team usually involves embracing management to some extent. And so I was actively against managing at that stage. I was like, I really don't want it. So I think that was probably a mistake in retrospect. I should have just embraced that as a career possibility. Besides that, it's hard to really phrase anything as a mistake, because I think the one thing I've done pretty successfully in my career is that when I know something's not working, I tend to move off of it pretty quickly. And that can be whether it's a team internally in a company or whether it's the company itself. And so long as you are moving off of your mistakes quickly, it's hard to really call them mistakes.
Yeah. And what was the important feedback you got? Could be someone from someone you work with or a manager or your current employee.
Yeah, I think some types of feedback I got, a lot of it was stuff that can seem small at the time, but turn into a much bigger thing down the road. For example, when I was at Airbnb, I was kind of working on this side project called the Knowledge Repo. And it was this kind of collaborative notebook tool. There was a way to take the sort of Jupyter notebooks and R markdowns and add a peer review process on top of it and render it in a web app. So that became a knowledge base. And I got encouragement from my manager to write about it, do a blog post, and eventually to open source it. And it's the sort of thing, it doesn't really rise you up any sort of career track, because there's no Airbnb bookings outcome that comes out of it. But it ended up being huge for my career. I think one of the most underrated things people can do is just write more about your job in public, in blogs, because all sorts of opportunities can find you when you write about topics that you know well, that you become an expert in. And then, of course, open sourcing a tool that has since gone on to have this incredible lifetime was a really big thing. A similar thing happened with Airbnb. We, like many other companies, our logging events, our event streams had a lot of dirtiness and they would break all the time and it caused a bunch of nightmares for everyone in the data world. I was kind of poking around the edges of this project that was trying to essentially create what we now call data contracts, things that are like you develop a schema of what a good event looks like. And if some engineer breaks the schema in their local development, it would break the build, would actually stop it. And so that was another place where a manager encouraged me. This actually would be really impactful if it became a thing. And so I started investing a lot in that and became part of that team. So it was kind of nudges from managers that, like, of the various things you're poking around, here's one that might be really important to you or really important to Airbnb. That was really good guidance.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And it's interesting you mentioned previously you were very against about becoming a manager and now you're CEO of a company.
I know, right? How life changes. How life changes.
Yeah. So how did you handle this change?
It's been a big learning process. At this point, I'm older and wiser, right? I was like 22 or something when I first joined Airbnb. So there's part of it is just having the reps of having managed a bunch of people by now. So I think that's a lot easier. But I think there's a lot of just, if you treat being a good manager and not like just something you just read a book and you're done, and it's just an ongoing craft of improving every day, then you can kind of make progress towards doing something that makes sure your reports are having fulfilling careers, that they experience growth, they're satisfied, they feel fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Are you hiring right now?
We are definitely hiring. So we are firmly in a hot market where we're kind of in a pole position to to accomplish everything we need to accomplish. So we are hiring sales reps, we're hiring engineers, we're hiring designers, pretty much across the board. There's this incredible demand for experimentation technology right now. Like, it's never been the case that Airbnb experimentation framework was on the market. It was something you could buy and bring into your own company, and much less a kind of more advanced version of it that like handles some of this guided support that kind of helps people feel confident in their decisions and socialize and evangelize. So yeah, it's very exciting times. I feel experimentation has gone mainstream in a certain way. Like, it's no longer the something that only like the fangs are doing. It's now like, basically the moment you have sample size, it's imperative to do it. And so it's an exciting time to be in space.
Yeah. And for people who want to check out Eppo, where can they try it?
Yeah, just come to geteppo.com, www.geteppo.com. So you can kind of see our philosophy. You can take it for a spin, a preview. And of course, just get in touch. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. If you just want to talk about experimentation topics in general, we love doing knowledge sessions. We have a statistics reading group we do every week where we talk about the latest and greatest in kind of stats papers. I think people would be fascinated by just how much thinking is going on at these PhD programs in terms of like causal inference and how do you make these statistical programs more robust, more powerful, delivering insights faster while still maintaining complete rigor. So we're constantly in that world talking about those topics. So come check us out at geteppo.com or reach out on LinkedIn.
Yeah, great. I'll put it in the show notes. So what do you think about the future of experimentation?
I think the AI thing is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, where we are now in a place where it's easier than ever to implement ideas. And with the down market, people are just much more conscious of the ROI of everything. So it's this kind of from a whole bunch of angles, it's becoming more imperative to measure and evaluate. And just to date, experimentation is just this incredible thing that gives you a clean read on evaluation. If you think of all the other ways in which you might try to measure something, a randomized control trial is just the purest form. Controls for all the other products going out, all the other concepts in marketing, and it like gives you this clean read. Now, I think in the future, as the cost of ideas goes down, whether via Gen AI or whatever else, like, we're going to see much more dynamic experimentation systems, stuff that like looks a little bit like personalization, delivering dynamically experiences to the right people. I think these types of systems is definitely what Eppo will be delivering. So that's kind of my bet on where everything's headed.
And how do you think data scientists should prepare for the future of experimentation and altogether with the shift in AI and large language model space?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a good time to start reading about these methods. And something we have observed everywhere, and at some point we'll just see if there's some study. But if you understand statistics and probability, you understand what a t-test is and what it assumes and how it works, and ideally go off from there and understand sequential methods and all a bunch of statistics, like, your salary is probably gonna be like 30% higher. Like, data teams benefit so much from this types of inference knowledge. And it's really important because, again, in a world where the cost of like the value add of knowing SQL really well might go down, it could, that'll make too many bets. But if nothing else, because there's a lot of SQL engineers out there, if not because AI is going to push into that, differentiated knowledge in causal inference will be really good. So I would definitely recommend investing in that or one of the more differentiated areas like data engineering or something like that.
Cool. I'm about to wrap up. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, thanks for bringing me on. It's been a pleasure talking to you and hearing about your Amazon background, talking experimentation.
Great. Thank you so much for having, what was I going to say? Oh, thank you so much for coming to the show. I learned a lot from our conversation and I'm excited to see how Eppo grows in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Daliana. It's been a pleasure being here.